The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.
The 2022 legislative session has officially begun, and lawmakers have a longer to-do list than usual before they gavel out in May. On this episode of Politically Speaking, we talk with Republican House Representative Dirk Deaton, who is the vice chair of the Budget Committee. That committee will ultimately decide how to spend billions of dollars in federal coronavirus relief money. It's a task he says is likely to take more than 1 year. We also talk about redistricting as well as a lightning round addressing other topics. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
We have to talk about things that matter to people.
I've tried to bring that same aggressive, iconoclast style with me to the United States Senate.
I think my district is a model for the state.
We put Missourians first.
You just kind of have to find the common ground with people.
I believe that this district deserves someone who represents their values.
After I came back to St. Louis, I started thinking that I could have a bigger role on the change that I wanted to make.
Hello and welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, State House and Politics reporter Sarah Kellogg. Joining me is my co-host. He is the political correspondent for St. Louis Public Radio,
Jason Rosenbaum.
And joining me this time in the studio in Jefferson City, he represents District 159, which includes McDonald and Southern Newton counties,
State Representative Dirk Deaton.
Welcome to the first recording of Politically Speaking of 2022. So, Representative Deaton, this is your first time on the show. Thank you for joining us. And secondly, for our listeners, tell us a little bit about your district.
Yeah, well, thanks so much, Jason and Sarah, for having me on. It's great to be with you and proud to be the first guest of the new year, and I think the first guest from McDonald County as well. That is where I'm from. I represent the 159th District of the Missouri House of Representatives, which is all of McDonald County, which just for your listeners is a bit of ways from St. Louis and is a county that borders the states of both Arkansas and Oklahoma. So it's the most southwestern county in the state. I give my friends in Springfield a hard time. They say they're southwest Missouri. I'm like, that's, you know, 2 hours northeast of me, you know. But southwest Missouri is where I'm from. I've got McDonald and then also a good portion of Newton County, which is Neosho, is in Newton County, the county seat, and Joplin is also in the northern end of Newton County. So it kind of gives people an idea where I'm from, a rural area mainly, a great part of the state, beautiful part of the country.
And how did you get involved in Missouri politics?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a, you know, I think everybody's path is a little bit different, and I've always had an interest for whatever reason in civic life and politics and government, although my family was, I mean, my parents, great people, you know, hardworking, you know, folks and you know, go to work and but not, you know, politically involved and running for office and those sorts of things. And so, you know, I was able to you know, connect with some good folks at a pretty early age and get involved at the local level. And then especially with term limits in Missouri politics, you know, every 8 years at least, there's going to be somebody new in the Missouri House. And so my seat came open and I just had a sense at the time I was elected in 2018 for the first time, just a concern about the direction of the country and that I'd had for a number of years. And my family, my grandfather came to Missouri in the 60s from Arkansas, and he came to start a business, was actually quite successful. And, you know, I'm thinking, hey, are people coming to Missouri today in the decade of, you know, 2010, 2020? You know, looking for opportunity, is the opportunity still here that he had for people to come here and seize their American dream? And I was just worried about the direction our state and country were going and felt we weren't as competitive as maybe we once were. And those sorts of concerns really drove me to get involved and to run for office. And fortunately, I was successful and the people elected me and have continued to elect me. And here we are today, and hopefully I'm able to make something of a difference.
So we are recording this literally the day before session starts. We have a lot to cover, so let's get started. What are your expectations for the 2022 session? What do you think will be prominent issues?
Well, I think the best way to go into any general legislative session is to have low expectations, and it's easier to meet them in that case. And so I try not to get too terribly excited. You know, every year, the one thing we've got to do is pass the budget. I suspect we'll talk about that at some point. This year's a bit unique in that we're going to have to pass perhaps a record number of budget bills. I mean, the operating budget, which is the, you know, for the fiscal year, and it puts, you know, state government into motion, covers the normal expenses. That always does happen. It happens in a number of bills. It's not just one bill. But then we have other bills for various other things and supplemental bills. We're probably going to have multiple supplemental bills this year. And so it's going to be a unique year in that regard. I do think we'll get that done. We obviously have redistricting to do, and I think those are looked upon as the have-to-do, must-do items. Everything after that, you know, I don't know if you want to consider that gravy to the extent we get anything done. I think, you know, due to the other conditions of this year and its election, people are you know, encumbered with other things, it could be difficult to get, you know, have a record year as far as legislative output. And perhaps that's not a bad thing. You know, was it Mark Twain who said, you know, the people's liberties are never in as much jeopardy as when the legislature sits. And so, you know, to that extent, maybe it's not altogether a bad thing that we don't pass a lot of bills. But yet we maybe still will. I mean, I think the logjam could break. It's theoretically possible. That we get a lot done. So, you know, I could see it going either way, but I'm not necessarily thinking we're going to pass a record number of bills this year.
Yeah, that kind of answers my question, which is, you know, between redistricting, the billions you're going to have to allocate through the American Rescue Plan Act, it being an election year. Yeah, do you think a lot's going to get done, or do you think that's kind of going to be the focus?
Well, and look, that's a lot. I mean, talking about the operating budget, I mean, from my perspective, and again, I'm kind of gone the budget track in the House. That's a full-time job in and of itself. It's a heavy lift every year, you know, and we get it done because we have to get it done. Otherwise, state government ceases to function and we shut down, which is not where you want to be. And so you have to get it done, but it's a heavy lift. And then talking about, yes, all the federal dollars that are coming in, that's almost like another budget. I mean, it is going to be another budget unto itself. And then with redistricting, I mean, these are heavy lifts, important items that will have an impact on Missouri for years and years to come. You know, we ought to take our time, get them right, and, you know, they'll be an accomplishment in and of themselves.
So last session, the Missouri House kind of jumped between having really intense debates over controversial topics to finding bipartisan consensus on tough issues. How do you expect this session to play out, especially considering that it is an election year?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I suspect it'll be something similar to what you described. I mean, every year since I've been here, there are those issues that are the kind of the lightning rods that everybody goes into their corners and has very, very strong passion feelings on, and they're perhaps the topic of the day, and passions run high. And we deal with those issues as the people who send us here expect us to. And based upon, you know, the district you represent and how your folks feel, then, you know, you advocate in one way or another on that particular item. And then there are other items that are, you know, I think perhaps less controversial and probably don't rise to that level. And they're an opportunity where, frankly, we do see a lot of bipartisan support for a lot of those initiatives, and I think, you know, that'll remain true, and we'll probably see a mixture of those types of issues.
So you tweeted something at the end of November that caught my attention. I'm going to read this tweet to you.
No.
I promise this isn't a gotcha show. So you tweeted, "Tomorrow begins the ability for legislators to pre-file legislation in Missouri. With it begins the talking season. Discussions occur, interviews are given, articles written, all about legislation that in many cases will never get a hearing and even fewer become law." So that caught my attention because, you know, it was the filing period. I guess kind of how do you weed through that legislation then, especially kind of during an election year?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it gets easier the longer you've been here. And I, you know, I don't know what the number is up to now for pre-filing. And but, you know, in a general year, you could have a thousand bills alone filed in the House, you know, hundreds in the Senate. So you say near 2,000 bills total between the House and the Senate potentially, you know, filed in a given year. And you know what? 10%, a lot less than that, ever is going to make it into law, you know, and it was kind of my point there. And so, you know, my first year, and it is overwhelming. It's like, well, I'm going to try to read every single one of these. And the reason it gets easier is a lot of these bills that are filed, they've been filed for many, many, many years. And I suspect they'll be filed for many, many, many years to come or until they're passed. And so you've seen it once, and, you know, there can be changes. But, you know, you do gain a bit of familiarity. And so the uptake is a lot easier as far as, you know, okay, well, I've seen this before. I know what this is. And so initially it's water from a fire hose, as they say. It's very overwhelming. I think it does become easier in time because a lot of these issues, you know, come back year after year.
So this is the first Politically Speaking of 2022, but on the second to last day of 2021 was basically Jason Rosenbaum Christmas, because Representative Dan Schall introduced the draft of the congressional map that redraws Missouri's 8 congressional districts. And if I had to summarize it best, and we'll get in a little bit more in the weeds, it basically keeps the current situation largely the same. The state would have a Democratic district in St. Louis, a Democratic district in Kansas City, a marginally competitive district in St. Louis suburbs, and then the rest of the districts are all super Republican. Obviously, there's been some blowback because there are a lot of people, especially on social media, who are Republican that want y'all to go 7-1 and just eviscerate Emanuel Cleaver's 5th district. What's kind of your reaction to the Schall map that got released?
Yeah, you know, I've looked at it and, you know, started to digest it as others have as well. You know, I assume it is a starting place. It's not the final product, so I suspect it'll, you know, change in some form or fashion. And, you know, I think everybody probably is most interested in, you know, kind of their own areas and where they come from. So I immediately looked to the 7th District. And, you know, one opportunity that I thought has, you know, existed, frankly, once, you know, Congresswoman Hartzler and Congressman Billy Long, you know, announced that they're running for the U.S. Senate, is that, you know, we have a unique opportunity here in that, you know, this is one redistricting cycle in which those two members of Congress, I don't think, necessarily are going to care what the 4th and 7th congressional districts look like. You know, we're a member of Congress, and I understand people want to be generally deferential to, you know, their people that are in those seats, or, you know, you know, they want to understand what they think about it. But, of course, when they're, you know, not running for re-election, I don't know that they necessarily care what it ultimately is going to look like. And so if there was ever going to be substantive changes there, then, you know, seemingly this would have to be the time. And I don't know that there will be, and there hasn't been a lot of talk about that. But, you know, I've always wondered about the 7th Congressional District, for example, and, you know, the way it's been configured for so long. And frankly, we know, you know, that obviously, you know, I'm a member of the majority party and the Republican Party, and you know, we have strong majorities in Jefferson City now, but, you know, for much of the state's history, most of it wasn't the case. And, you know, the other party was controlling redistricting for so long, and you know, I suspect one time they were probably trying to pack as many of, you know, my Republican friends and me into the 7th, you know, as you could in Southwest Missouri. But, you know, I've wondered, hey, is, like, where I'm from, McDonald, Newton, you know, Jasper County, would it make more sense to have, like, an I-49 corridor district? I mean, in some ways, we're very rural. I think we've got probably more in common with Barton, Dade, and, you know, Bates County than we do with Springfield and Greene County in some ways. And I'm not suggesting it's going to happen, but ideas like that have interested me. But having said all of that, if you look at this map, it looks a lot like the one we've had previously with some, you know, minor modifications, and we probably stick to something more like that, I suppose, just due to people's conservative nature as to, you know, not thinking outside of the box.
Yeah, and one of the reasons why I agree with you on that has to do with the fact that Governor Parson did not call you into special session. And this gets a little wonky, but I'm going to try to explain this as non-verbosely as possible. So basically, the legislature has to pass this map and has to go into effect immediately. Because if it doesn't, it goes into effect on August 28th and the primary is on August 2nd. And I don't know about you, but I don't know if Missouri wants a situation where there's legal ambiguity about whether they can even have congressional primaries on the same day as the August 2nd primary. Like, that's a nightmare scenario. And unfortunately, we're recording this on Tuesday, and I'd say unfortunately for 7-1 map proponents, Representative Justin Hill is resigning tomorrow, and you all are going to drop below the 109-member threshold, which means that you likely need Democratic votes in order to secure that emergency clause, which in my analysis basically makes going after Emanuel Cleaver's district impossible, because there is zero chance any Democrat is going to vote for the emergency clause for that. And I also think it makes it more difficult to make Ann Wagner's district significantly more Republican. I got to just ask flat out, how much anger is within your caucus at Governor Parson for not calling a special session and giving Democrats in the House this much leverage over redistricting?
Well, we've been, in the interim, just now coming back, I've not had an opportunity to visit with, many of my colleagues. We haven't had a caucus meeting, obviously, yet this year. So, I'm not sure that I can necessarily speak to what, every member of the caucus feels. I'm sure some certainly do have very strong feelings. There perhaps is a spectrum. I to anyone who asked, and I, tried to make my opinions known to the best I could, that I was an advocate to come back during the interim for a special session for redistricting. And I would have been fine even for some other topics, frankly. Potentially for a special session, and feeling that it was needed and warranted, that obviously didn't happen. And it is the governor's prerogative to call or not to call, and he chose not to, and had his reasons for doing so. And you can understand them. I mean, it's not that they're not good reasons. And look, it's not on him alone. We do have a provision and the ability to call ourselves back as legislators. Now, there's a reason that's rarely, if ever, happened, just due to the threshold that it takes. The number of members, both the House and the Senate, that have to sign on to such a petition makes it virtually impossible. But still, if enough of us felt that it was warranted and needed, we could have theoretically done it ourselves. And obviously, we didn't do that. So, I mean, it didn't happen. Here we are. We got to make the best of it. I just hope that we don't, get beyond this and look back and all, just objectively say, oh, well, we should have, maybe done it, late last year, because obviously we didn't, and that's not an option at this point. So hopefully it works out smoothly and doesn't cause any problems like you mentioned, Jason, as far as the election dates and all of those conundrums that we don't want to see, and confusion that would be needless. And so hopefully we don't, find ourselves in that situation and are able to get it done in a, time frame that's reasonable.
We need to take a quick break, but we'll be right back.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
And we're back on Politically Speaking. I'm Sarah Kellogg. I'm joined by St. Louis Public Radio's political correspondent, Jason Rosenbaum. And our guest today is Representative Dirk Eaton, who represents District 159, which covers a part of Southwest Missouri. Let's get back into it. You are the vice chairman of the House Budget Committee. The first thing your committee will likely tackle is a supplemental bill that appropriates funds for Medicaid expansion. I know many of your colleagues vigorously oppose this move, but after the Supreme Court decision, do you really have another option?
Yeah, great question. And that's, right up there with redistricting, and it's a fast timeline. We are going to have to pass supplemental for various reasons, not just for our state's Medicaid program, but yes, for our state's Medicaid program. And you're right. And this is, not only did some of my colleagues oppose expansion, I opposed expansion, and very vigorously so. I was about as involved as anybody, and as outspoken on that as anybody. And maybe it'd be helpful, and you know, please indulge me because I've not had the opportunity to, this is a great form, and I do enjoy the long form. I think it's helpful to these sorts of discussions, and you all are unique in what you offer here and for your listeners and for the citizens of the state. And so
flattery will get you nowhere, yeah. State Representative, but continue.
Well, you know, and it's all true in this case. And so it's a very complex issue, I guess, what I'm saying. So, a little background might be helpful. And a lot of your listeners no doubt remember that Amendment 2, was placed on the ballot and placed in the Constitution, although by a pretty narrow vote, that expanded eligibility for Medicaid, kind of known as Medicaid expansion. And there was a pre-election challenge saying that, hey, that violated Article 3, Section 51 of the Missouri Constitution because it would appropriate funds. It required the spending of money. And the Missouri Constitution says an initiative can't spend money unless it raises new revenues. And this one didn't raise new revenues. And that pre-election challenge, the Cady decision, the court said, no, it doesn't necessarily appropriate funds. And so it can go on to the ballot. And so it was passed. And then in this last session, the 2021 regular session, the General Assembly vigorously debated it. And we determined and decided not to fund expansion, not to put it forward. And so the executive had started to begin to try to implement it, paperwork, things of that nature. And then they withdrew all of that. And then plaintiffs sued. The trial court said Amendment 2 did, in fact, violate Article 3, Section 51, that it should be stripped from the Constitution. And then on appeal to the Missouri Supreme Court, they ruled, well, no, there was no violation of Article 3, Section 51. And further, to everybody's surprise, the legislature did fund it. And now the choice is actually whether or not you want a Medicaid program at all. And if you're going to have a Medicaid program, then you have to fund expansion. So your only decision is if you fund Medicaid, then you're funding expansion. So you have a decision in the legislature, and your decision is to have a Medicaid program or not, which, I don't think is much of a decision as all, and it's a very tenuous legal reasoning and understanding. And, I'll just dispel. I think a lot of people thought there was a lot of political gamesmanship that was going on there and that this was always known to be the outcome by people like me. And I can just tell you emphatically that was not the case. And I always thought we, were comporting with the law and on sound reasoning. If they'd included a funding source, we would have never gotten here. It would have been implemented, no question. They didn't. And we did what we did. And now, here we are. That's kind of how we got here. I do think now that we're here, and look, I totally agree with or disagree with the Missouri Supreme Court. As I've said, I think they were totally wrong. You read their opinion. I thought it was, not even a fair handling of the Attorney General's arguments. They didn't even speak to, I think, his strongest arguments. They didn't even try to negate them. They just passed over them. I was very disappointed in that. But expansion has taken place. People have started to enroll. In some ways, I think it's water over the dam based upon this court's reading of our legislation and the Constitution, unless that's changed, and which I don't anticipate happening this year. But unless or until that happens, I think we're here. And again, the question is now, are we going to have a Medicaid program or not? So unless people are willing to completely discontinue, which I'll have that conversation if people are interested in having it, then here we are, and we're going to have to, fund our Medicaid program. Otherwise, it's going to be put in jeopardy and not be available for those who, we've been trying to protect it for, and the aged, the blind, the disabled. And so, that's the discussion as it exists now.
Now, there has been some discussion, particularly within the conservative caucus in the Senate, about doing some technical changes to the bill, which would effectively zero out funding for expansion. And I just want to make clear, I've talked to some attorneys who vigorously disagree that that's even possible. But let's just say that it is possible. The impact of that, if it was successful and survived a court challenge, you would be kicking 50 or 60 or 70,000 people off of Medicaid. And I'm the last time Republicans lost a significant amount of seats was 2006 after the Medicaid cuts. It seems from like a political standpoint, that would be catastrophic if you all did that. Is that kind of your feeling as well?
I mean, I think it's a futile to consider that further. I mean, you're right. I mean, it's not. I mean, the courts wouldn't listen to that. I mean, I don't agree with their decision, their opinion at this point. But I mean, under the Planned Parenthood decision, they would say. I mean, if you're talking about, you know, zeroing out, you know, eligibility or something for, I mean, they'd say, well, you can't do that in an appropriations bill. That'd violate change substantive law, which is in the Constitution, which expand eligibility. I mean, they said in the Doyle decision, which, you know, is the Medicaid expansion decision, that, you know, if you're going to have a Medicaid program, then, you know, any dollar available for Medicaid, a percentage of that dollar, you know, has to be available to the expansion population. And so, which again, I think is a gun to the head, which is what the U.S. Supreme Court said in the NFIB decision, saying states didn't have to expand because the federal government was saying all states have to expand Medicaid if you want any federal dollars. And the U.S. Supreme Court said that's ridiculous. That's a gun to the head. That's not a choice at all. And that was a 7-2 decision. Only Ginsburg and Sotomayor dissented on that. And so, I mean, I think that kind of tells you where the Missouri Supreme Court is at on this and how out of step they are. But here we are. So, no, I mean, that we'd be right back where we are. You know, that's just not going to happen. That's what I'm saying. If at this point the Missouri Constitution needs to be amended, and what was placed in Amendment 2 needs to be changed in some form or fashion, likely to see a different outcome. So I think, from my perspective, as someone who wasn't for expansion and thought it was a mistake, that you know, now we need to continue to talk about reforms and accelerate that discussion as it relates to the broader program. And because it's still, before expansion, we were on an unsustainable track. It was about to take up 40% of the state budget. I mean, it's just unsustainable. It's still unsustainable. Now it's even more unsustainable. So we have to talk about reforms and to bring the program and spending under control. And now that's what we need to pivot to and accelerate. And you know, the time has never been better to consider those sorts of initiatives.
You're an excellent segueer, Representative, because Missouri is going to be getting close to $1 billion from the American Rescue Plan for expanding Medicaid. And correct me if I'm wrong, legislators put a few hundred million dollars in a Medicaid stabilization fund for basically what you just mentioned, which I assume could, you know, pay for the state cost of expansion. With this money, though, like, this money is finite. You're going to run out of this eventually. Is the focus now on changing the program to make sure that the state portion of Medicaid expansion is as low as possible? And is then the next question is, do you try to find a dedicated funding stream to pay for the state portion so you're not taking money away from general revenue 5, 6, 7, 8 years into the future?
Yeah, great question. I think that's right as it relates to the enhanced FMAP, the 5% that we will earn on the existing population, so it's not on the state population. And the FMAP, just, you know, for your listeners, is the federal medical assistance percentage. It's essentially the percentage that the federal government participates or pays for the Medicaid program, and the other portion the state would pay. And so for expanding, under some of the recent legislation passed out of Congress, there was a 5% increase in the FMAP for the existing population that they would supply to the states for 4 quarters or 2 years, which it does appear that, you know, will be around $1 billion. And I do think that all of that money, in fact, all the enhanced FMAP we get, ought to be tied and related to defraying the costs for our Medicaid program. That seemingly makes sense as to where those funds should likely be allocated. But you're absolutely right. And there's, you know, some disagreement on how long those funds will last, when they will be exhausted. And of course, it ultimately depends on Medicaid expenditures. But they're going to run out. It's a question of when that will be, not if. And so, yeah, then what do we do? And you're right. If we don't find a dedicated revenue source, then it will increase the takedown on GR and be a burden there. And so, yeah, maybe that's a possibility that we could potentially further amend Article, or what was Amendment 2, is now the state constitution, to see if you know, voters want to provide a dedicated funding source or not. We do have a few years, though, probably before we need to, you know, find out what that is or what that looks like.
So what funding streams would you suggest?
Well, I mean, you know, if you're going to voters, then it could be, you know, you're talking about probably raising some sort of a new tax. And so you could, I guess, construct it in any way you want. New taxes, not something I'm generally supportive of. And so, you know, but again, that's where we've gotten to at this point. I mean, that's the conundrum. It's like, you know, you got to pay for it. So how do you pay for it? And so it's general revenues we're taking from, you know, schools and all the other sorts of, you know, critical government services and things people want. And we have a very limited, finite pool of general revenue resources, or otherwise you're going to have to go somewhere else. We'll make do until or if, you know, a new funding source is identified. But again, I think this really goes to, there's a reason why the proponents didn't include a funding source, because they knew it would never pass. And it's, you know, it's kind of a wolf in sheep's clothing here. And now here we're kind of left to pick up the pieces and figure out and try to make it work. And we'll do the best we can. It's going to be difficult. But again, and that's why we need to find savings in the program. And that needs to become the priority, because I think that's achievable and scalable and something we can do. And frankly, we've got to do it.
So we're going to shift a little bit. What are your expectations for how American Rescue Plan money is divvied out this year?
Yeah, and again, this is something we'll be able to do over the next few years. There's a lot of federal funds, you know, in play here. You know, I think we'll hopefully be very deliberative about how we do it, thoroughly scrutinize it. You know, I do appreciate, I think the governor has been very open to legislators who call with questions, and of course they're formulating their plans, and you know, they'll soon you know, reveal, I suspect, in the state of the state much of that, including with their, you know, budget requests. But I think, you know, we need to look specifically, you know, try to work from some sort of a philosophy as to, you know, how to do this, and to make sure that we don't have ongoing liabilities or expenditures, or these aren't new programs that are going to require ongoing funding, because again, this is one-time funding. Even though it can be spent over a number of fiscal years, it's finite, it runs out, it won't be continuing. And so, you know, we got to make sure we don't have obligations, and you know, that it's not wasted, even if it's not on a new program or something that would have ongoing expenditures. Is this really the greatest need? You know, maybe it's a nice, shiny new object, but, you know, if the foundation is crumbling, well, we need to address that. And I think that's going to be the challenge. There's a lot of unseen needs within state government, the nuts and the bolts, make sure the trains are running on time, so to speak. That's the things that I hope and that we need to do, and this provides a unique opportunity to do. I'm afraid that the challenge is going to be, and there is going to be a drive to want to do that. As you can understand, we'll do some of that, the shiny new thing, the new building, what have you. So that'll be some of the challenges.
So Missouri and other states have until the end of 2024 to allocate the funding. You know, is it possible that the state takes its time and doesn't spend it all this year? You know, maybe next year there'll be more ARPA funding kind of considered.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, we're not going to exhaust it all this year, nor should we. I don't even think that's possible, frankly. I mean, this is becoming such a large amount of money. I don't think we couldn't expend it all if we would want to. It would be irresponsible. There would be no way to, frankly, do it, appropriately. And that's still going to be a challenge. I mean, there's so much, you know, government spending occurring right now, and the economy is very hot. To get people to work on these sorts of projects is going to be a challenge in and of itself. So, no, this will need to be done over a number of years. And as I speak on that, I mean, look, Washington has you know, taxed in a deceitful fashion in just printing trillions of dollars. And we've seen the inflation that it's causing. And so, you know, I do think we need to keep first and foremost on our minds, you know, how this is impacting taxpayers and how maybe we can give taxpayers some relief based upon, this newfound revenue that we've discovered. And, you know, because people are paying for it at the gas pump, at the grocery store. And, you know, I don't think that's appropriate, but here we are. And these decisions D.C. has made, and again, states, state lawmakers, appropriators like myself, we're here trying to make the most of it. And what do? You're going to send this money back? I mean, that probably does Missouri taxpayers a greater disservice. But still yet, it's for fiscal conservatives like myself, it's an interesting position to be in here, and one that you know, I don't necessarily always enjoy, frankly.
In the last few minutes we have left, I do want to go through this lightning round where we touch on some issues and you can respond either in a yes or no answer or in a paragraph. Do you think the legislature will have to move the filing period because of the uncertainty over state legislative and congressional redistricting?
I think it is very possible, potentially even likely, that that will ultimately occur.
Do you think that the legislature will bar private businesses from being able to require the COVID-19 vaccine?
That seems to me unlikely. I'm sure there will probably be some legislation on that, but specifically the way you asked that question, completely bar private employers from requiring that, no.
Yeah, I was very specific. I mean, obviously there's the Biden vaccine mandate. I'm not talking about that. If the vaccine mandate didn't exist, I'd be talking about could Boeing require their employees to get the vaccine without government coercion. I want to be clear to our listeners what I'm talking about there. Do you think that the legislature should legalize marijuana for adult use in order to get ahead of this ballot initiative that is being circulated right now?
You could make a very good argument for that. In fact, I mean, objectively, probably should, just based upon the experience we've had with medical marijuana, and that, you know, even if we all agree that there's some change that needs to be made, it can't be made because the Constitution would have to be amended. So taking the legislature out of this is seems like the worst possible scenario. And so, yeah, all things equal, that probably would be the best thing. I doubt that would happen.
Do you think that your colleagues will pass a requirement to show a government-issued photo ID to vote?
Yes, I think that's perhaps not. I mean, that's one of those things that could get tied up with some number of other issues. But, you know, I think there's a very good chance that that could happen. We'll certainly hear a lot about that and other election integrity issues. I suspect something will be done on that front.
Do you think that with that bill to reimpose the photo ID requirement that the legislature will expand opportunities for in-person absentee voting? So, for example, there will be a 6-week or 3-week period where you could go to your Board of Elections and vote early.
Yeah, I'm sure that'll be a discussion. I don't know that that would necessarily ultimately be included. It's not something that I would advocate for or support. I'm a big fan of Election Day. You know, I think, you know, we have that period of time which people advocate for their candidacy and their candidate of choice for a reason, and that Election Day is the secure and the safest way in which to vote. And so that's not something I would look to support.
And my final question, my favorite election question of all, will the legislature pass a bill that would set up a runoff for statewide and congressional elections?
No.
Also known as the Keep Eric Greitens Out of the U.S. Senate bill. That's my observation, not the representative's.
And that's that. So thank you so much for joining us on the show, Representative Deaton. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is a part of the University of Missouri-St. Louis. You can follow me on Twitter at Sarah K. Kellogg with 2 G's. You can follow Jason on Twitter at
J. Rosenbaum.
And Representative Deaton, where can people find you on the internet where you would like to be found?
Yeah, well, you can find me on Twitter at Dirk E. Deaton. That's D-I-R-K-E-D-E-A-T-O-N, or on any number of other platforms easily found.
All right. Until next time, so long.